Greetings and delectable morselations, my adumbrated listeners, and welcome to this November 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this hyper-resplendently resplendent science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Happy Thanksgiving to all you American and Canadian listeners, and, those of you elsewhere, happy end of November. I'm sorry, I can't think of anything more clever to say than that. Okay, so let's start out with a plug. I did an interview on Jesse Willis's science fiction audio podcast a couple of weeks ago. His cast is the Science Fiction and Fantasy Audio Podcast, with which you may be familiar. Jesse tells me that it will be out at the beginning of next year. I think most Starship Sofa fans may want to listen to it. It's actually quite interesting. We discussed the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Mound, which was released as a book cast on my own website, Uvula Audio, about a year ago. The Mound is a classic Lovecraft story that very few people know about because Lovecraft was paid to write it for somebody else when his regular publishers were taking forever to pay him for his other actual published works. That was about 1930. The story was eventually published under Zelia Bishop's name in 1940, but it absolutely screams Lovecraft. I mean, how many times can one guy use the words cyclopean and eldritch in a short story without giving himself away as the author? Jesse and I had a long discussion about the story, its history and implications in the context of other writers, and about my narration of it. Any Lovecraft fans who are curious can find my recordings of The Mound on the Mature Fiction section of uvulaaudio.com. Additionally, there are plans in the works to narrate the shorter story, the prequel to The Mound, The Curse of Yig, and I should be getting to that soon. At any rate, enough of the plug. Let's get going with our first story of the night. Here is the headline of the day. Women smell better than men. Well, duh, I knew that. Certainly my wife smells a heck of a lot better than I do. I mean, heck, if men smelled as good as women, I would consider even playing for the other team. But no such luck. Everybody knows that women smell better, and all right, this is just silly. Enough of this nonsense. You've probably already figured out I didn't quite mean what I said. What I meant to say is that women have a better sense of smell than men do. Now, that actually makes sense to me, since my wife can often identify whether my 6-year-old needs a bath from across the room, whereas I can't really tell if he needed a bath if he was draped over my head. So do women have a better sense of smell? It has been argued by some anthropologists that there are so many more fragrant perfumes and powders and lotions sold to women and not so many to men as a cultural phenomenon. But is it more than that? Are women simply more sensitive to it because of biological differences? This is a controversial question that's been batted around for years. The latest attempt to answer this question comes from Dr. Roberto Lent of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro and his collaborators, who used a new method called isotopic fractionation to look closely at the olfactory bulbs of adult men and women. The story was reported earlier this month in the journal Plus One. The big finding? Well, it seems that women have up to 50% more olfactory bulb cells than men do, possibly accounting for smell sensitivity differences between the sexes. Gender differences in olfactory detection have been investigated for years and are suspected to influence social behaviors. While these differences certainly result in part from cultural conditioning, some evidence, such as the ability of babies and mothers to recognize each other by smell, suggests that there are biological origins. Lent said in the article, quote, "To distinguish between socially driven sex differences and biologically determined ones, it is important to investigate and find the neural correlates of behavioral/cognitive specificities of each sex," unquote. As I said, there has been some controversy about the smell question and the sexes for years. Evidence of a biological origin has been mixed. Researchers have looked into this question using electrophysiology, neuroimaging, with some studies actually confirming the superiority of women detecting odors, and others didn't. In physical terms, the olfactory bulb measures, well, slightly larger in men than women. And this particular paper says that unlike other mammals, Neurogenesis does not occur in adult human olfactory bulbs, so the fact that one is bigger than the other in males versus females is kind of puzzling. Lent says, quote, "The absolute number of cells for this purpose may be an accurate parameter, disclosing whether the processing units in the brains of men and women do differ," unquote. To count olfactory bulb cells, Lent used a method that he invented called the isotropic fractionator. His team obtained post-mortem brains from 7 men and 11 women over the age of 55 and within 8 to 18 hours after death. In all cases, the brains came from people who were cognitively normal, did not show pathological markers in their brains, and did not work in fields relying on olfactory function, such as cooking, perfume making, coffee tasting, beer brewing, anything like that. The isotropic fractionator lyses cell membranes, leaving behind undamaged nuclei, which the author stained and counted under the fluorescent microscope. Although female olfactory bulbs weigh less than male bulbs, they contained an average of 16 million cells compared to about 9 million cells in males. When the researchers looked exclusively at neurons, women had about 7 million as opposed to about 3.5 million in males. I mean, that's about a 50% difference. Lent stated, quote, "Generally speaking, larger brains with larger numbers of neurons correlate with the functional complexity provided by these brains. Thus, it makes sense to think that more neurons in the female olfactory bulbs would provide women with higher olfactory sensitivity," unquote. While it's possible that the increased number of olfactory bulb cells in women may account for the functional differences in smell, the results raise some questions. In what specific circuits do these additional cells function? How and why did the difference of cell number arise during evolution? And do cell numbers change as odor sensitivity decreases with age? I suspect that the House of Chanel can answer none of these questions. Next up, Ebola. You may have noticed I have been very quiet on the Ebola problems that have arisen over the last couple of months. I will continue to do so because of the embarrassing and pathetically stupid aspects of the whole fiasco, both in the U.S. and abroad. It is a sad statement that the CDC, the U.S. agency tasked specifically with handling problems like this one, have become so horrifically amateurish, risking the health and even lives of thousands of people. Instead of a diatribe, we can chat a bit about Ebola genetics and what makes this nasty virus so unique, or at least one of its aspects. Reporting this month in the online journal MBio, Dr. Christopher Bassler and his associates at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai have found that filoviruses, including Ebola and Marburg, produce a wider range of gene products during infection than was previously thought. Bassler found that viral RNA polymerases, those are the enzymes that help make mRNA messages for making proteins, stall at certain genomic locations during transcription and add additional nucleotides in what he calls a quote-unquote non-canonical viral RNA editing process. Bassler says, quote, "Our study suggests the Ebola virus is making forms of proteins previously undescribed," unquote. The researchers first identified these modified viral RNAs during a series of deep sequencing experiments focused on understanding transcription, replication, and the viral life cycle of different filoviruses, including the Ebola species responsible for the current outbreak in West Africa, and as well a related Marburg strain that caused an outbreak in Angola in 2005. Bassler's sequencing data revealed several previously unknown regions within these viruses, where editing resulted in the addition of non-template encoded residues in several viral mRNAs, including those coding for glycoproteins, those are proteins with sugar on them, nuclear proteins, and polymerases. There are other viral polymerases that are also known to stutter at certain locations, resulting in similar non-templated nucleotide additions. But this is the first time that such a mechanism has been identified in filoviruses. What's kind of interesting is that when the authors studied a variety of Ebola strains from different outbreaks, they found that the non-canonical editing sites were very conserved among the different strains examined. Bassler says, quote, "While clearly expanding the diversity of mRNA products produced by the virus during infection, the impact and relevance of these modified RNAs is not entirely clear. We know these changes occur, but we don't really know yet what it means in the biology of the virus," unquote. He also noted that since there are many aspects of how the viruses replicate that are not yet understood, he said, "We need a complete description of how they grow to develop new strategies to treat infections," unquote. So the upshot? The Ebola mystery virus makes protein that we didn't know it did, and we don't know what those proteins have to do with infections. Now you begin to see why it's so bloody hard to treat this virus. Well, okay, you want mysterious? How mysterious can any organism on Earth be? How about electric bacteria? Is that mysterious enough for you? Dr. Derek Lovely at the University of Massachusetts has found bacteria that completely bypass known sugar metabolism to entirely feed and excrete pure electrons. This is pretty amazing if you think about it, but at the same time, entirely expected in the realms of biology. Most bacteria and higher organisms go through all sorts of hoops to create energy, taking glucose and breaking it down through a series of reactions in order to move hydrogens around so that they can power the process of making adenosine triphosphate, ATP. That's the most common of all the energy fiscal units. I guess it's a bit like the energy version of a $20 bill. Well, Lovely has found bacteria in the Potomac River that have bypassed all the glucose breakdown stuff, and they deal directly with electrons and protons for energy. Lovely says, if you stab an electrode into the muddy sediment of the Potomac River at just the right spot, then current will flow. The culprit is a class of microbial power plants capable of transferring electrons from inside their membranes to the outside world. By stripping electrons from unlikely organic substances like acetate or lactic acid and passing them to metallic compounds beyond their cell walls, these bacteria effectively breathe metals like humans and E. coli breathe oxygen, unquote. Lovely discovered back in 2002 that in the absence of oxygen, an electrode immersed in marine sediment would acquire a bacterial coating, consisting mostly of the members of the family Geobacteriaceae. These bacteria could actually extract electrons from acetate or benzoate and pass them directly to the electrode, no chemical intermediates at all required, and produce a measurable current. But if you kill the culture, then the current died as well. Well, that's pretty amazing, but even more confusing is that it is a setup for a huge biological question, which is, how do these bacteria even move electrons across a membrane that was designed specifically so that electrons couldn't go across it? Lovely and his colleagues found that in the Electrobacteria S. onidensis, the route to move electrons out through the membrane involves an iron-rich protein complex that creates what is essentially a wire through the outer membrane. Lovely says, quote, "You end up with a conduit that's a continuous chain of 15 or 20 individual hemes that go all the way through the membrane like a wire through the wall of a house," unquote. In his most recent study in the November issue of the journal Nature Nanotechnology, Lovely's team used an electrostatic force microscope, a form of atomic force microscope, to inject electric current into the bacteria's reproductive pili and watch the charge propagate. The results suggest that the pili function not by electrons hopping from carrier to carrier, as in common biology, but like a traditional wire or even a carbon nanotube. Lovely says it was completely unexpected. If you think that's pretty amazing, Lovely and company have even isolated an electrobacteria that they call Mare Profundis that can take up electrons from an electrode and pass them to oxygen. No actual food is required by this bacteria at all. He says, quote, "Mare Profundis builds all the biomass and they do all their metabolism using nothing but a string of electrons," unquote. That is as close to a multifunctional 3D printer as has ever been observed in nature. If you can imagine being able to control an actual animal cell in this manner, you could generate a whole organ with nothing more than the correct genetic instructions and a bit of electric current. Lovely is now predicting the future for these organisms will be in things like desalination plants, because there would be so little energy needed as input. He says, quote, by harnessing bug power, it may be possible to turn desalination into a net energy gain, unquote. Other applications that have been suggested include remote sensing, soil remediation, and even biocomputing. It's just incredible. I mean, I'm seriously inspired with these microbial fuel cells. I just have to figure out what to do with them. I think even just running my iPhone on an electrobacterium would be cool enough, given the lousy battery life I'm getting now. At any rate, the next story is, well, it's kind of batty. It's certainly not in a good way. Scientists use all sorts of organisms for models, from mice to nematode worms to fruit flies and even monkeys. One of the organisms that I would not have considered to be a good one for study of a biological system would be bats. Yes, bats. Well, the Cape Crusader would be horrified, but this next story is about using bats to tell us more about memory and sleep deprivation. Dr. Irenaeus Rudzinski of the Mammal Research Institute in Poland published a study in the Journal of Experimental Science in November, which examined the connection between memory loss and lack of sleep. But he used bats to do this study. Rudzinski says, quote, sleep deprivation may affect our ability to consolidate memories and keep them from being transferred from the short term to the long term. It turns out that animals that hibernate to conserve energy, like bats, may suffer similar problems, unquote. The paper points up that both REM sleep and slow-wave sleep are reduced during torpor, and that animals that have recently emerged from hibernation spend a lot of time sleeping to repay the deficit, ironically enough. However, the jury was out on the effect of torpor and hibernation on rodent memories. Some species seem to form long-term memories fine, while the memories of others are impaired. Rudzinski was intrigued by the possibility that the low body temperature associated with torpor could impact memory formation, so he began testing the memories of chilled great mouse-eared bats. Seriously, bats. Wouldn't dormice have worked just as well? Keeping the bats at either 22 degrees centigrade or 7 degrees centigrade, Rudzinski trained them to find food in a maze. And both groups of bats also had to learn the location of a dry perch when they were placed in a wet testing area. Testing the animal's memory of the location of food in the maze and where the perch was in the wet area, the team found that the bats' memories were equally good. Their body temperature did not affect their ability to form memories. Rudzinski says, quote, the lack of clear cognitive effects caused by the decrease in body temperature could be explained by a bat's life history, unquote. He further points out that bats live in complex environments and that this could have forced them to develop compensating mechanisms that ensure that their memories are sound. Okay, here's a cool planetary geography story. Dr. Alexander Hayes of Cornell University reported the mapping of the methane ocean on Titan at the November 10th meeting of the American Astronomical Society's Division of Planetary Sciences. This is the first time that anybody has mapped the depths of the three methane seas on Saturn's moon Titan. The largest of these, Ligeia Mare, contains enough liquid methane to fill three Lake Michigans. That gives you an idea of its size. The sea bottoms showed up on radar observations from NASA's Cassini spacecraft, which arrived at Saturn in 2004. Researchers directed the probe to bounce radar off of Titan seas to see how choppy they are. A closer look at the data showed a second, weaker reflection after the first, indicating that the radar penetrated the sea and reflected off the bottom. The eastern part of Ligeia Mare averages from 20 to 40 meters in depth, and elsewhere in the Ligeia Mare, Cassini did not detect a second reflection, suggesting that the seafloor drops below Cassini's range of about 200 meters. Hayes also presented the discovery of a quote-unquote magic island, which is what he's calling something that appears to be a floating island in the Kraken Mare, the largest of Titan's seas. He says that the mysterious feature sits on top of the sea and is most likely wind-driven waves or flotsam stirred up from somewhere below. I note regretfully that Hayes does not suggest that his mysterious island may be a giant floating alien spacecraft. Next story. Quantum computing. Is it finally getting closer to reality? Will your smartphone soon be quantum computing smart? Maybe. A paper in the November issue of the journal Physical Review Letters by Dr. Mark Tame of the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa suggests that, yeah, we're closer. Tame employed a 20-year-old algorithm called Simon's algorithm to demonstrate the benefit of using quantum computing to solve certain problems. Simon's algorithm provides instructions for a computer to determine whether a black box returns a distinct output for every possible input. It was the first example of problem-solving software that quantum computers should be able to execute exponentially faster than conventional computers as the problems get more complicated. Tame and his colleagues ran a simple version of Simon's algorithm on a computer with 6 quantum bits. The quantum computer ran the algorithm twice on average to solve the problem. A conventional computer would require nearly 3 tries on average. The results match Simon's predictions, the researchers say. The gap in the amount of tries would rise exponentially as the number of possible inputs increased. Although Simon's algorithm has no practical applications at all, Tame says that the experiment is a step toward implementing quantum software for data encryptions. High fidelity encryption. Well, if quantum computing keeps the NSA and hackers out of the hair of the public, then frankly, more power to quantum computing. The final story of the night involves DNA and memory and is actually related to the quantum computing story. Are you worried about long-term storage for your computer information? Imagine if we had a storage system that could last for virtually thousands of years with little change in the memory storage. And no, I'm not talking about hard copy books. Well, someone has thought of this before me and decided that DNA would make the perfect analog storage system. Doctors Fahim Farzafad and Timothy Liu from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have developed a method to make genomic tape recording a reality. They report on this in the most current issue of Science. DNA is an incredibly effective and efficient example of information storage, with multiple levels of encoding and flexibility. It's for that reason that many researchers have toyed with the idea of manipulating DNA to store information. In fact, several groups have gone so far as to create elaborate coding schemes to place information into non-coding regions of DNA that can be later read out using various technologies, for example, DNA sequencing. While it's clear that information can be placed into DNA, is it possible to directly record cellular events and histories into the DNA of a living cell for later review? Liu and Farzafard report a new technique that actually makes it possible to record in the DNA not only that an event has happened, but also the timing and amplitude of transcriptional signals received by living cells. This creates for the first time a form of inducible analog memory in cells. The basic concept behind the new technology is fairly straightforward. In response to a biological signal, a single strand of DNA is produced inside the cell, then in the presence of a co-expressed recombinase, targets a specific genome location for homologous recombination with single-stranded DNA. What's the translation of that? It means that the newly made single-stranded DNA is targeted to a specific part of the chromosome and then forced to become part of the chromosome at a particular location. It's a little the way I can take a bit of music and ta-da! Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of the team. And there the music is gone. It was very easy to put that music, edit it in, with the rest of my mellifluous tones. Liu says, quote, "We are looking for a way to express single-stranded DNA in vivo so that these synthetic DNAs could be incorporated into the genome as a form of memory under the control of exogenous inputs. Thus, systems that involve reverse transcriptases were the reasonable direction to try, since these enzymes should convert RNA, whose synthesis can be put under transcriptional control, into DNA, unquote. Liu and Farzafard decided to try using a new class of bacterial DNA called retrons. Retrons are a unique class of bacterial DNA sequences that encode a reverse transcriptase and two other RNA components, a primer and a template, all in one DNA cassette. You may or may not know or remember this, but reverse transcriptase is an enzyme which, using RNA as a template, can actually read it and make DNA. So hence the single-stranded DNA. The authors realized that if they added an inducible promoter to a retron cassette, then modified its template to identify a specific genomic location, retrons could be the perfect way to generate single-stranded DNA for their analog memory system. While it proved pretty straightforward to put an inducible response element, such as the one that responds to the presence of sugar lactose, for example, on the retron, altering the template proved more challenging, requiring Farzafard and Liu to identify the essential regions of the template strand. After some trial and error, they were able to create an inducible retron that generated a modified single-stranded DNA template. They next tried incorporating the new single-stranded DNA into bacterial DNA. Previous research had shown that beta recombinase could efficiently recombine synthetic single-stranded DNA oligonucleotides into bacterial DNA. So the authors reasoned that the same recombinase, if expressed in their cells, which generated single-stranded DNA, would generate specific genomic changes at known locations in response to transcriptional signals. After putting together and testing all the pieces, a proof-of-concept experiment was performed. First, to demonstrate the system's ability to produce single-stranded DNA in response to a signal, the retron cassette was placed under the control of a lactose-inducible promoter. When induced by the sugar, the single-stranded DNA could be detected, but the effect was abolished when the authors tested a retron with point mutants in it, mutations in the reverse transcription gene site. Then they assessed the ability to recombine the modified template that they were generating into bacterial DNA by co-expressing beta recombinases in the cell. And the authors call this new system SCRIBE, for Synthetic Cellular Recorders Integrating Biological Events. They now have the ability to toggle recording functions based on signals, record the magnitude of a signal, and also determine the timing of a signal input. The reason the signal magnitude is possible to obtain using the SCRIBE system is because this approach looks at a cell in populations, not as single cells. But Liu says future work could actually focus on single cells and the efficiency of the SCRIBE system. Quote, "We are working to increase the efficiency of writing. This would allow us to perform high-efficiency genome editing and implement single-cell memory," unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Men, don't challenge your female friends to a smell-off. Let your bat get enough sleep. He probably needs it. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.